addiction, autism, dementia, oh me, fatigue, sleep disordered, ADHD, oh my. All these mental disorders that seem to be driving the world crazy lead us to ask, can we eat our way to mental health?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 797th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Nandi who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at MetroFarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet. How you doing, Rick?
Good day, Michael.
Folks, the list of mental disorders from which we now suffer is long and frightening. Addiction, autism, dementia, oh me. Fatigue, depression, ADHD, oh my. The National Institute of Health estimates that worldwide more than one in four, that's more than 25%, now suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder, and that half of those with a mental disorder have two or more disorders. Now, all is not bad about the mental disorders that now affect our thinking. In fact, the disorders now generate hundreds of billions of dollars for those who manufacture and distribute pills. And that's enough money to float a good-sized country, or two, maybe even three. But all those who do not suffer, who do not manufacture or distribute pills, all is not so sweet for the rest of us. Those who suffer from mental disorders must suffer from them, and those who do not suffer from mental disorders must uphold up those who do and pay for their pills, which, as mentioned, cost enough money to float a good-sized country, or two, or three. Though all those pills we are buying may be alleviating and even controlling some symptoms, they certainly do not seem to be eliminating the mental disorders, which leads us to ask today, why do so many people now have so many mental disorders? Does what we eat or do not eat affect the development of our brain and mind? And finally, can we eat our way to mental health? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Pam Killeen, who is a nutritionist and author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. Pam, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on your show, Michael.
I have pleasure. You're out from Canada to speak at the Weston A. Price Foundation Wise Traditions Conference in Silicon Valley, right?
That's right. I'm here for the weekend to speak about one of my favorite topics, and that is, how to fix a broken brain. And unfortunately today, so many people in the population feel that feeling. They just feel like something is not right in their brain, that they're struggling with depression, they're struggling with brain fog, with anxiety, they have obsessive thinking, they can't sleep at night. So something has gone awry.
Something is amiss. Well, I wanted to ask you, Where does Wise Traditions fit into what you're going to talk about?
Well, for about 10 years now, I've been teaching the work of Dr. Weston A. Price, and mm-hmm. he is actually a Canadian dentist who emigrated, moved to the United States, and had a practice in Cleveland, Ohio. And back about in the 1930s, he started to see changes in children's mouths. He started to see cavities. He started to see crooked teeth. And what he did was he started asking questions. He started wondering why in one generation did he see this type of degeneration going on in children. And, I mean, keep in mind, he was treating the parents of these children, and they had perfect teeth. He didn't see cavities. He didn't see crooked teeth. And in one generation, he started to see these changes going on. So what he did was he traveled around the world, and he studied primitive cultures. And he studied their diets. And what he did was he considered not just their dental health, but their overall health. He said, you know, as long as the primitive cultures had healthy teeth, that they were also healthy mentally and physically as well. And what they were doing to stay so healthy had to do with the foods that they were eating, the local foods that came from their region.
But just a quick question, though it would be easy, you know, for a person to examine someone's teeth and say you're healthy, how would Dr. Price look at their minds and their brains?
He made remarks remarks throughout his journaling, and his remarks pertained to their happiness, that they just seemed incredibly happy, even though some of these cultures were in very harsh environments, you know, very harsh climatic conditions, for example. He would see that not, you know, under these conditions, one would think one would be less happy, but he would see, even in these harsh conditions, that they were very, very happy, that they got along, they were very cordial. You know, it just seemed like there were very cooperative environments to live under. And so today, of course, there's more ways to be able to quantify happiness. Mm-hmm. That, you know, he didn't do that, but it's still, if you read his work, you can see that these people were mentally very stable.
Okay.
And he didn't see the signs of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and all these other problems.
So something changed within a generation, and as a dentist, he was able to observe the very tangible result of that change in people's teeth, and then he just stopped in his tracks and said, what the heck is happening to us?
Right, because he's seen in neighboring villages or towns, areas that were not too far away from these more primitive cultures, in other areas where they were importing westernized, industrialized foods, that once they brought in these foods and used those foods to displace the more nutrient-dense traditional foods, that's when he started to see problems happening. And when we look at the diet and what's happened to our diet over the last 100 years with the rise of this industrial food complex, if you will, we're 100 times more likely to be depressed today than we were 100 years ago.
Wait a minute. 100 times more likely to be depressed
today. Depression is our number one cause of disability. Right now, it's in North America, it's our number one cause of disability. Worldwide, it's number four on the list for the leading cause of disability. But by 2020, the World Health Organization is saying that depression is going to be the second leading cause of disability worldwide. So we have a tsunami on our hands. And depression, of course, when you're depressed, you're far more likely to lead yourself into some sort of addiction.
Which leads us to your new book, Addiction, mm-hmm. The Hidden Epidemic.
Right. And in my book, what I'm talking about essentially is the food and mood connection. What has happened to our diet, where we have displaced some very key nutrients that stabilize our mood, that stabilize our nervous system, that feed our brain essentially. And so because we've displaced so many foods that are nourishing us mentally, this is why we see so much mental instability today. Now, I'm not saying it's the only thing that's going on, but I put it at the top of my list in terms of the leading contributing factor to this bad mood epidemic that we're seeing.
And what are the manifestations of the epidemic, of the addiction epidemic?
Well, what we're seeing, and one of the reasons why I wrote my book, is because I had a revelation one day, and I said, you know, we're turning our children into addicts. You know, the local school system where I live did a survey, and the teachers basically said that about 28% of the children that they're teaching have some sort of mental disorder. And I thought
which would be right in line with what the National Institute of Health says for the general population of the world.
You're absolutely right. So I said to myself, well, you know, when I was a kid, that certainly wasn't the case. When I think about my peers as a child, I think they were pretty normal kids. And now, 25, one in four? And so I said, this is not a situation where they're better able to diagnose this issue. It's when you look around and you see these behaviors in children, there's something that's just not right. And it's not a Ritalin deficiency. It's not a drug deficiency problem, as you were talking about in the introduction. This is clearly a case of malnutrition. But unfortunately today, people are not looking at that as a piece to the puzzle, because drugs are very easy to turn to as the answer. But
and very profitable, too.
Extremely profitable. But unfortunately, when you start medicating these mental health disorders, you're ignoring the true cause of the problem. And so what ends up happening is because the body is still not getting the proper nutrition, 10 years from now, then how are these people going to feel? 20 years from now, how are they going to feel? They're going to be more and more and more mentally unstable as the years progress. And I'm worried because our children, you know, I know what it's like. I had chronic fatigue for many, many years. I know what it's like to try and drag yourself out of bed in the morning. But when I see these children and they can't get out of bed in the morning, it's not cute. It's not normal. There's something very wrong when a child isn't excited to jump out of bed in the morning and excited to go and learn at school. There's something very wrong with that scenario because that's not normal for childhood.
Well, at least to jump out of bed in the morning, but I don't know if it's all that normal to be all that excited about for a young boy to be all that anxious about going into school and learning things. But I understand what you're saying, and there is something amiss.
Curiosity. Yeah, there's a natural curiosity. They tend to, I remember being excited about learning when I was at school, but maybe I was a geek. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, so, we're going to have to take a quick break, Pam, but when we come back, I'd like to really delve into this whole notion of why so many people are in this fix right now, and we've sketched out a little bit and like to go into depth with this, because if there are more than one in four of us, more than 25% of us are suffering from mental disorders, and half of those are suffering from more than one, something truly has gone amiss. Does it relate to what Dr. Price saw in the 1930s, that tremendous transition that led from healthy teeth to decayed teeth? Is that what happened to our mind? Right back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Pam Killeen, and you.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, lucky for you and I and me and everybody else that we know, we're not among these numbers put out by the National Institute of Health. More than 25% of us now suffer from mental disorders, and half of those who suffer from more than one mental disorder. Pam Killeen, are those real numbers?
Oh, yes, they're very real, very, very real. But I don't think it should be a reason why people should be running to the pharmaceutical industry for answers. In my book, I talk about Aldous Huxley and his book or his novel, Brave New World.
Brave New World, there you go.
And, he foreshadowed a lot of what we're seeing today. And in the book, of course, he talked about the entire society being controlled by one drug, and the drug happened to be called Soma, and it was a fictitious drug, but in terms of the symbolism and what it means for us today, it was very real, because right now in the United States, over 50% of the population is taking at least one prescription drug. And
Are you kidding, 50%?
Right, and there are 17,000 drugs on the marketplace, Michael. And you know what these drugs are supposed to be doing? They're supposed to be making us healthier. But I look around and I say to myself, what's the definition of insanity is to keep doing what we're doing and expecting different results? 17,000 drugs on the market supposedly here to make us healthy, and I don't see that happening among society.
Well, that's the issue. Now, let's go back before the 1930s. Is there any way to know positively one way or another whether we were this crazy as we are today?
No, this is definitely, there's definitely a rise. There's people out there journaling this information. Robert Whitaker is one of them. He's been journaling and calculating the incidence of mental health, and there's a clear rise in mental instability in society today. And it's really more prominent, oddly enough, in English-speaking countries. So we have more depression in English-speaking
countries. Now, does he say why we're crazier in English-speaking countries than... I mean,
the reason why, and this is just my opinion, I think the reason why is because English-speaking countries tend to be the countries who bought into the low-fat lie the most.
Ah, okay. Before we go head down that road, I think about before 1930s, and I think about some of the manifestations of mental illness, and I wonder if self-medication wouldn't be a good indicator of mental illness, as it is today. You know, when we see people stumbling down the street, you know, and we think them to be intoxicated for one reason or other. But oftentimes these are people who are suffering from mental disorders and are self-medicating. Back before 1930 and Dr. Price's discovery, were not there a lot of alcoholics? And could not they have been mentally ill as well?
Well, but the precursor for addiction, and there's, I'm oversimplifying a very complicated subject, but it's brain starvation that actually leads people to self-medicate because they don't feel quite right, so they turn to something in order to try and feel better, even if it's for a temporary period in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we see what's happening today, Michael, I call it the perfect storm. We have a tremendous amount of mental instability in society, coupled with the fact that we have the availability of more substances, more activities that are highly addictive, that are very easy to fall victim to in terms of becoming addicted. So I think it's the perfect storm. I think that as long as people are mentally unstable, they need to have something to make them feel better. You know, prohibition and these types of initiatives simply are not adequate enough. They're inadequate in my mind because they're not solving the problem. If somebody is not feeling well, they're going to climb a mountain to find a drug or something.
To feel better, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in animals we call it pica and cribbing. You know, you'll see a mule chewing on a fence post or something, and they're looking for something. They're looking for the nutrients that they've been deprived of, so they'll, you know, chew on anything to find it. Take us back then to that critical period that of Dr. Price discovered in the 1930s, and let's talk about the diet then. Well, first of all, is there any indication that the rate of incidence of mental disorders is accelerating? I mean, are we going crazier faster?
Oh, definitely. Even the World Health Organization is saying that depression is going to be the second leading cause of disability worldwide by 2020. So absolutely, they're forecasting more and more mental instability in society, not just here in North America, but worldwide. And what we see happening, of course, is the rise of big food, the industrial food complex. And so as we see more and more industrialized foods and we see more and more of these edible oils on the marketplace displacing more nutrient-dense animal fat.
There we go. So let's go back to the 1930s then and talk about our diet before, you know, when we still had healthy teeth. And as Dr. Price observed, you know, the parents had healthy teeth, and in one generation, the teeth went to hell. So what did we eat before then?
Okay, well, let me actually take you back further in history. If we look at the time, over 99% of our history were hunter-gatherers, and when we invented agriculture 10,000 years ago, that's when archaeologists started to see cavities in humans. That's when they started to see things like osteoporosis, anemia, infectious diseases. So we started to see physical degeneration after we invented agriculture, and that would have been an era when we would have...
No, dental decay in pre-agriculture people then?
No, apparently not. We had very, very healthy teeth while we were hunter-gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there you see when you start displacing the more nutrient-dense animal foods and replacing them with more plant-based foods, we already see signs of physical degeneration. But then that's fast forward to what I call the second assault on our food supply, and that was the Industrial Revolution and the rise of things like the steel mill and the flour industry when we started, again, displacing more of the animal foods and replacing them with more plant-based foods. And then it would have been things like cookies and crackers and biscuits and breads and so on and so forth. And then by the middle 1800s, actually, then you see the rise of the canning industry. So, again, more plant-based foods in the diet. And then at the late 1800s, you start to see rise of things like you know, Cracker Jack and Coca-Cola and Pepsi. And then 1909 was the invention of hydrogenation, and we start to see the rise of things like margarines in the marketplace. And the margarine, of course, displaced the more nutrient-dense food, butter. And then in World War II is with the last and the worst assault on our food supply, and that was the rise of all the foods that we see in the middle aisles of a grocery store because technologies were developed during World War II to allow for soldiers to have what are known now as meals ready to eat. And so that technology that was used during World War II is essentially what we see reflected in the aisles of the middle in the middle aisles of a grocery store today.
Not to also mention the fact that World War II and I helped develop the modern fertilizer industry and pesticide industry as well.
Absolutely. So I always ask people, let's remember Little House on the Prairie. Let's remember these old shows in the 1800s. And remember those scenes when you go into a general store. What was in that general store? Well, they had maybe some flour and some sugar and maybe some candies. You know, they had fabric. They had all sorts of items for sale. But did you see these in the middle of? Absolutely not. Did you see these foods? No. You saw that back then, probably 80% of the population was living on a farm. They had their chickens, they had their pigs, they had their cows. They were eating a very sustainable food supply back in the 1800s and would only go to the general store for the odd item here or there. And today, of course, what we have is the middle aisles, tens of thousands of foods lining those middle aisles. And what are they doing? They're actually blocking our view from seeing the real food, which is at the back of the store.
And to get to the real food, you have to go past all that other stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And that contains very little nutrition,
mm-hmm.
and it's the idea is you put a penny's worth of grain in a box and charge a dollar for it, right?
Right, and then the other thing is we have to keep in mind that the hydrogenation process that was invented in 1909, what it did was it allowed for these products to be on the shelf because these fats, these edible oil-based fats, are more shelf-stable than things like butter and lard. So one system essentially enabled another system to exist,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to undo that today is going to be a political mess.
Okay, well, we love political messes because that's where we live. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. We're talking with Pam Clean, author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. We're talking about what happened back in 1930 when Dr. Weston A. Price, a dentist from Ohio, happened to notice that the parents had healthy teeth, the children had rotting teeth. And then what happened to the rest of our body, and specifically what happened to our brain and our mind. How did these modern foods affect the development of our brain and its ability to think? That's where we go next on the Food Chain. Michael Olson, if you'd like to pitch in, 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. Right back with Pam Clean. Addiction, autism, dementia, oh me! Fatigue, sleep disorders, ADHD, oh my! All these mental disorders that seem to be driving the world crazy lead us to ask, can we eat our way to mental health? Well, we were healthy way back when, and then something happened around the 1930s, and it was obvious to a dentist named Weston A. Price, who noticed that the children's teeth were all rotting and the parents' teeth were all healthy. So what is happening that's different? Pam Clean, author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. Pam, we started eating these manufactured foods, these industrial foods. I call them cheap foods because really that's what they are. And something happened to our body, but what exactly happens to our body when we eat those cheap foods?
Essentially what they do is they starve your body at the same time, and they contain a lot of ingredients that are potentially very toxic as well. So you're getting a double whammy when you're eating all these highly processed foods. But what we've done essentially in turning to these industrialized foods is we have displaced more nutrient-dense animal foods that contain some very key fats that stabilize our nervous system, in particular the long-chain fatty acids. And it's these long-chain fatty acids that are crucial for mental health. They're crucial for the functioning of the adrenal glands, for example. And these fats contain some fat-soluble vitamins, vitamins A and D, vitamin K, K2 in particular. And these fats are very crucial for the functioning of, for example, your adrenal glands. And part of what I have to do to get people back running on all eight cylinders is I've got to address the repair of their adrenal glands. And the best foods to support the adrenal glands are going to be things like butter and cod liver oil because they are very rich in these fat-soluble vitamins. And so what happens is the fat-soluble vitamins play some very key roles. They're called activators. And what they also do is they help the body assimilate minerals. And your minerals are your spark plugs. If you don't have your minerals in balance, then you're not going to feel a lot of spark, essentially. You're not going to feel quite right.
But Pam, how did we get there? Because if you walk down the center of any supermarket, one of the things you'll see 80% of the packages is low fat.
That's right. And, you know, what we have in the world of nutrition is we have a very clever marketing ploy, and it's called negative nutrition. This is well known. This is information you can dig up at universities that study nutrition. And negative nutrition has been used for potentially thousands of years to demonize one food in order to sell another food. We see it in the Bible, you know, people demonizing pork and shellfish. You know, I'm Irish and Scottish descent, and my ancestors are very well known for being physically healthy. And so when you consider that the Irish and the Scottish were that healthy, and what did they eat? They ate a lot of shellfish and even included pork in their diet, and they were healthy for it. But you see the demonization of food, and it's a ploy in order to distract you from buying that food, so you pick up another food, you buy another food.
So it's a way of control. It's a means of control then.
So when we see the invention of the hydrogenation process and the rise of what is known as the edible oil industry, these foods wanted to get their competitors out of the way. And their competitors for the edible oil industry would have been things like butter, lard, and tallow. So they used a very sophisticated marketing ploy in order to demonize those traditional nutrient-dense foods that kept us healthy for thousands of years and replace those foods with less nutritious foods like margarine, spread, shortening, and so on.
And if you actually saw what margarine looked like, you would never touch it, right?
Absolutely. If you look at the stages, if you go online and potentially type in flowchart for margarine and you look at how it's made, you would not consume it. I mean, anybody who was in the know and looked at how, you know, even using things like a nickel as a catalyst. I mean, nickel is very toxic, and unfortunately, you know, you can accumulate a not lot of nickel just because of eating a lot of processed foods and things like margarine.
So they steered us away from the saturated fats, from the animal fats, from the fats that had all the good nutrients and gave us partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. So what did that do to our nervous system? You said that the fats are very important for our nervous system.
That's right. So it did a double whammy. So at the same time as they damage our nervous system, because these are new foreign materials that our body is not used to assimilating, it also it's on the same time it's toxifying us in a sense, and at the other side of the spectrum, it's starving us because we're not eating the foods that actually stabilize our nervous system, feed our brain, support our hormones, support blood sugar levels, and all these wonderful things that should happen if you're eating enough animal fat in the diet. You know, I like to tell people, let's put things into perspective here. Before World War II, when we sat down and ate 3 square meals a day, we sat down and we had a full breakfast, a full lunch, a full dinner, food was homemade, right? We didn't back then have fat phobia, cholesterol phobia, liver phobia, red meat phobia, egg phobia, chicken skin phobia. We didn't have any of those food phobias before World War II. And back then, we were much healthier than we are today. So what we have to do is understand, number one, we have to understand negative nutrition, this marketing ploy, how it's been used to market products that we simply don't need, that are damaging our health. And we need to return to common sense and return to the foods that we ate when we know we were healthy. I mean, when we ate 3 square meals a day, there's no question about it. We were much healthier than we are today. And there's historical precedents to show that eating 3 square meals is indeed healthy. Our ancestors didn't have to think about what to eat. They knew what to eat through wisdom. Mm-hmm. And that wisdom, unfortunately, has been taken away from us.
Taken away, stolen. Well, let me talk a little bit about the brain and the mind. Is there a difference?
When the body is out of balance, it's hard to have positive thoughts. Mm-hmm. It's hard to be optimistic.
So the brain is the physical part, and the mind is like the software that runs things?
That's a good analogy, yeah. I mean, when I start working with people who are brain-starved, they're very negative, they're very pessimistic, they're exhausted, they have anger issues. You know, they're just not happy, joyful people. And when you see the biochemistry get stronger and stronger and stronger, they turn into a whole different person. They're who they were maybe when they were a teenager, before their body became incredibly, brain-starved. So they remember in their teens, potentially getting out of bed and being excited about the day. They remember in their teens that they were optimistic and joyful and happy. You know, they remember that. There's some part of their history where they know that they had those feelings. But after a time when they're starving their body and toxifying their body at the same time, decade after decade after decade goes on, and they're more and more fatigued, more miserable, more pessimistic, and they can't go back to the way they used to be, which is unfortunate. I know that this situation is reversible, by the way.
No, is this relatable then to mental disorders?
Yes, I mean, I get to see cause and effect. I get to see people who have a quote-unquote mental disorder, and I put them on a full program. And if they follow the program accordingly, whatever it is that they are sick with mentally, they overcome it. So I know that mental disorders are indeed curable. I know that they can go back and lead a full life.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I would like to, if you're so willing, to lead us through a case study. To please don't mention anybody's name, but pick somebody and tell us of their disorder and how, you know, a diet of wise tradition could bring them back to some semblance of sanity. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Pam Colleen, author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. And you, phone numbers today, 831-479-1080. We've got some phone callers we're going to pick up after this break. 831-479-1080, right back. Well, I just had a spooky thought last week. I did a radio program with the food services director of the public school system who talked about getting fats out of the diet of school children. Pam, Colleen, what happens when we take all the fats out of the diet of our school children?
Oh, well, then young developing brains, this is a very, very scary situation. I have a historic book in my library at home, and it's called School Feeding. And the woman who wrote this book at the time was considered a world-renowned expert in school feeding. And they talk in the book about children with behavior and learning problems and how what they would do with these children is they take them out of school and put them in special schools, not, Michael, to discipline these children. What they did was they took these children out of school and put them in these special schools so that they could properly feed them.
Wow.
And then they would see these children just blossom, their behavior, their learning abilities improve. And what did they feed them? They fed them meat and they fed them butter. They went on a high-fat diet. And what they realized is that these children were from typically lower socioeconomic groups, that they did not have the money to buy things like meat and butter, and they had displaced those foods already with things like margarine, cheaper foods like margarine and canned vegetables, for example, coffee, whatever the case may be. These children were not consuming the nutrient-dense foods. And they knew it at the time, Michael. And the tragedy I see in this story is that 100 years ago, they knew more about nutrition then than they do today. And, you know, they just knew that red meat and butter had special qualities.
You know, and I would suspect, Pam, that has a lot to do with the industrialization and the concentration of money and the food chain. I don't know, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. So we got a couple of callers here, but I really wanted to hear a case study from you. Can you throw something out for us before we go
right.
to the phone?
Right, I can think of so many cases. One case is a woman in her late 40s, for example, that I'm working with even still to this day. I talked to her the other day. She was on the phone with me. She was giggling. She was laughing. She's able to work now. When I first met her, she could not work. She was diagnosed with debilitating bipolar disorder, and she has been on my program, and she's just blossoming. She's just doing so well. Her husband is so thrilled because he has his wife back. You know, it's so gratifying.
What did you do to her?
Well, it's her work. She's doing most of the work. She's eating 3 square meals a day. She's gotten over her fat phobia, her cholesterol phobia. She's making meals from scratch. I have her resting as much as possible because resting is a very key component in terms of resuscitating the adrenal glands. She's doing saunas every day. She's doing coffee enemas in order to build bile production. Bile production is very key because it's one of the exit routes for heavy metals. And it's the heavy metals, unfortunately, that will mess with neurotransmitters in the brain. So in terms of producing things like serotonin, dopamine, all of these feel-good chemicals, you can produce as many of these wonderful chemicals as you want, but if you have too many heavy metals in the way, then things are going to misfire, miscue, and you're not going to feel, you're just not going to feel right.
So, okay, we're going to go to the phones right now and talk with Jim. Jim, welcome to the Food Chain. You're talking with Michael Olson and Pam Killeen. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think that it's pretty obvious. I think the problem actually started before the turn of the century, and you can look at a lot of the neurological problems that were described in medical literature. Right then when the industrial age was really heating up, and it's the replacement. Basically, what, in my opinion, what it is, it's the replacement of fat-rich diet with a carbohydrate-rich diet. And, what's really apparent to me is that you look at the indigenous diet of the people, what they subsisted on for thousands of years. Like, for example, Northern Atlantic people, subsisted on cold water fish. Then you come over and you look at Alaska Natives, they subsisted on cold water fish. And you look at,
there wasn't exactly a lot of warm water up there to eat, get warm water fish either.
Right, but you get a lot of good essential fatty acids from those fish, and, yeah. And you look at the neurological problems that those people are, both those types of people, different racial groups have developed, since they've been on the industrial diet, and you can kind of form a pretty, correlation of what happened.
Pam, it sounds like he's talking your tune there.
Oh, yeah, that's music to my ears. It's wonderful to hear. I think your listening audience is already catching on to what's been going on. And this double whammy that we're getting, not just the brain starvation from not eating the nutrient-dense foods, but by replacing those foods with foods that are not just lacking nutrition, but very toxic for our bodies as well.
Well, thanks for the call, Jim. Let's go to Annalise. Annalise, welcome to the Food Chain. Pam Killeen, Michael Olson, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael Olson, and thank you, Pam, for being there and discussing this sort of from a foundational beginning of nutrition understanding of how we have starved our body and created problems. I have a question that kind of goes beyond that. I've been involved with nutrition and wellness, and I really want to thank you again, Michael, for having brought the issue of GMOs so much to the public. My question is this, Pam. We have a lot of food availability. Actually, yes, people eat a lot of fast food. I don't. I cook at home. I cook very simply. Both for myself and for any animals or people that are in my house, they eat a simple diet. I don't go to just a vegetarian diet. I don't think that that's healthful, but that is my choice. But what I do see is a lot of food, whether it's you're talking about animals that are fed.
Really quickly with your question, 30 seconds.
What can they do? What can we do with so much of our food that has been adulterated by fertilizer and pesticides?
Okay, no, that's a great question.
Okay, hold that question. We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll pick it up when we come back. Can you stay with us, Annalise?
Absolutely.
Okay, do stay tuned,
thank
folks.
You.
This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson having too much fun with too little time. Do stay tuned. Right back. Hey, we're back. This is the Food Chain. So much to talk about in so little time. Annalise, you had a great question. What was it?
The question is, how do we eat a nutrient-rich diet when we have so much food that is adulterated by pesticides, by fertilizers that become part of the animals and part of the plants that we eat? How do we get away from that? Because it isn't a choice anymore.
Pam Killeen, that's a fastball right down the heart of the plate.
Yeah, well, I have a couple of things just about that. Number one, I'm working with some people who are unable to work. They're on extremely limited budgets. You know, they have debilitating chronic fatigue, debilitating depression, whatever the case may be. They don't necessarily have the money or the means to be able to go out and buy the, what I call the gold standard. They don't necessarily have the ability to buy grass-fed beef, pastured eggs, pastured chicken, raw milk, whatever is under that umbrella of a traditional, ideal traditional foods diet. They, for whatever reason, can't obtain the farm fresh aspect of it. So what I tell my clients is the gold standard for, beyond that that ideal standard is to just be able to eat 3 square meals a day. That doing really, really well by eating 3 square meals a day, you're doing better than most people. If all you can do is buy your food from the outer periphery of a grocery store, if that's what's most comfortable for you, then that's what I want you to do. So I don't want anybody feeling guilty or feeling like what we're talking about here is an elitist thing. It's not. I think that there are going to be a lot of what I call conscientious consumers who are willing to drive extra distance, to pay a little bit extra money right now, you know, to get these, you know, gold standard foods from local farms. But I just want people to do the best they can with what they have, because I've seen too many people scared off of eating red meat, eggs, and unfortunately what they feel like they're left with is eating things like soy and salad, and guess what's going to happen is they're going to end up really, really sick because they're not eating any of the animal foods that they need to stabilize their nervous systems and feed their brains. So I just leave people with that mantra. Do the best you can with what you have, please.
Annalise, quick follow-up before we leave.
I want to thank you, Pam, for what you said. However, I think there is a lot of problems with people getting to those kinds of food sources, and our food sources themselves, even for the farmers, are adulterated. So then what?
Right. Well, here at the Weston A. Price Conference, here's the other thing I wanted to point out, is we have some wonderful people who are networking, connecting the consumer to the farmer. Michael, this is probably one of the most important things that you're doing with the radio show, is to be able to introduce the consumer, not just to the concept of farm fresh foods, but get them the resources they need so that they can find these wonderful farmers.
Weston A. Price Foundation, easy as that. Annalise, thank you so much for that call. Where do we go from here? Tell us how to get started.
Well, I think the baseline is to make sure you're eating 3 square meals a day, so that when you wake up in the morning, you're having a full breakfast. You're making your meals from scratch. You're eating the way we used to eat when we woke up in the morning, had breakfast at 7 a.m., we had lunch at noon, we had dinner at 6 p.m. When we had that traditional eating pattern, we were healthy. So number one, 3 square meals. Number two, get over your fat phobia and your cholesterol phobia. Start eating the foods that we know kept us healthy for generations.
Good fats, not bad fats.
Eat your good fats, those wonderful traditional nutrient-dense fats. Start looking for sources of lard. Start finding some tallow. You know, just pound on that butter. You know, if you're eating traditional bread, make sure it's a sourdough bread.
Pam Clean, one quick question before we go. Do the vegans love you?
I'm a recovering vegan myself. I was 9 years vegan. It almost killed me. The vast majority of my clients were vegetarian, vegan, or near vegetarian.
There you go. Pam Colleen, author of Addiction, The Hidden Epidemic. Thank you all for tuning in. Hey, go to MetroFarm.com and answer this question. Why do so many people now suffer from so many maladies? Right back. Next week. Thank you very much, Pam.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.